Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books on Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jingyi Li from the University of Arizona. In today's episode, we have Drs. Katrina Moore, Hong Zhang, and Jing Xie with us to talk about their new edited volume, Beyond Filial Piety, Rethinking Aging and Caregiving in Contemporary East Asian Societies, published by Berghain last year. From perspectives of anthropology, sociology, public health, public policies, and etc., this book examines the social support for the elderly in East Asian countries who share the common value of filial piety, which is an essential component of Confucianism. Welcome, professors. Thank you so much for joining us in New Books on Japanese Studies today.
Thank you very much, Jingyi.
Thank you for having us.
So, Just before we dive into the book, I'd like to kind of know what you do outside of writing this book. So what do you all research about? And I guess to trace back a bit more, how did you end up in what you're doing right now? Let's maybe start with Dr. Xie.
Okay. Hi, my name is Jean Shea, and I'm a professor at the University of Vermont, and I also direct the Health and Society Program and the Global Health Concentration in Anthropology here. And my research is recently primarily on aging and caregiving in China, specifically spousal caregiving, and also elderly volunteers supporting aging in place. And I've been, you know, I studied Asian studies and Chinese culture and society and language as an undergrad, and then studied anthropology as a graduate student. And I also have done some research in the U.S. and Canada related to aging as well.
Interesting. And how about you, Dr. Zhang?
So my name is Hong Zhang. I am a professor of East Asian Studies and Anthropology at Kobe College. That's in Maine. My research is elder care and aging in China, and also population policy, especially the one-child policy and its impact on daughters and also elder care in China. I have been working in this field for the past 20 years, and more recently I have been collaborating with Dr. Xie through several panels, and then also this book project. It's really a pleasure to work with her. Last year, we almost planned to go to China for follow-up research, but the pandemic disrupted our plan.
That is, that's awesome. When I was reading the book, I thought that part, you picked really well, not great angle. Not that I know anything about caregiving, but it's something that my parents are worried about. So my parents are in China, and they always, when we talk to each other, they always blame me for leaving them there and to take care of themselves. So I thought that was quite interesting. How about you, Dr. Moore? I understand that your research is primarily focused on Japanese studies.
Indeed. Yes, I'm an academic based in Sydney, Australia. And over the time I've worked in academia as an anthropologist, I have lectured both at Harvard University, and I have lectured at the University of New South Wales. And my interest in Japanese studies sprang from a strong interest in the health angle, and in particular, the mind-body connection that is sustained in arts such as the chanting of the No Theater, and that was a major part of my interest. Another interest I have, and a longstanding one, has to do with population aging, and that interest has led me to research and train at the university in Canberra called the Australia National University Demography Program. And that interest in both the health of people and also the larger population level changes in the society prompted me to look for opportunities such as this collaboration. And so it's been a real eye-opener for me to expand my interest from Japan, which has been my primary area of investigation, to East Asia more broadly. And the book covers not only Japan and China, also it looks at many countries such as Singapore and Taiwan, South Korea. So that's been a real broadening of my area of interest as a result of the collaboration.
Yes. Incredible. I thought your book came out right in time because now with the COVID pandemic situation, I guess a lot of people are starting to pay more and more, even more attention to the problem of aging. For example, in Japan, they just recently started vaccinating elderly above 65 years old. And apparently they have a really large number of population to go through. So yeah, I definitely hope people get some inspiration from your book. So how did you end up working on this project?
Well, Dr. Zhang already mentioned that we had done a panel on aging and caregiving with the American Anthropological Association and the Association for Asian Studies. And kind of that was the spark for it. But then later, there was a AAS meeting in Hong Kong. And Dr. Moore was at that meeting. And so sort of over time, our team came together. And it took a lot of networking on our parts to get, really representative, really good researchers in either anthropology or social work or social gerontology to represent most of what we would call East Asian societies. As Dr. Moore said, we have chapters on rural China and urban China and Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, Japan, and Korea. And it just has been such an amazing experience to work together with Dr. Zhang and Dr. Moore, because just what we were trying to cover was such a huge amount of demographic and cultural and historical and social change kind of scholarship and cultural scholarship that it's just been amazing to learn from them, as well as the other authors in the book.
Yeah, I thought it was quite amazing that despite having to work with so many different disciplines of four different cultures, you were able to find similarities between them and find potentially common solutions or for future references. So I thought that was quite impressive. Now I want to get into a bit more detail about the book. So the center of your discussion is aging, but instead of talking about aging as in getting old in age, there are multiple things that you refer to by this term. Could you talk about what aging means in the context of this book?
Sure. I mean, I may leave some out because I'm not looking at what we wrote. And as I've been rereading what we wrote, it's like, wow, we wrote that. it's amazing how the mind just sort of moves on. But part of it is looking at aging as in individuals growing older over time. But part of it is Dr. Moore and Dr. Dong talked about demography and the aging of populations having a larger proportion of people who are over the age of 60 or 65, depending on what benchmark you use. And also thinking about aging in terms of societies aging over time. And I think I probably have left something out if someone else wants to jump in.
Yeah, well, we were very interested in looking at how families and communities respond. So we're looking at these different levels at the same time, not only on the individual basis, but more on the social communities and the social structures that have evolved to respond to this. And the book provides quite fine-grained analyses of what is happening in certain sections of a society through ethnographic portrayals. And at the same time, we were very interested in providing a sense for the fact that aging is a life course issue, so that at every juncture of the life course from birth all the way to after death, meaning even after a person dies, there are certain experiences that are needing attention by other members of a community, whether it is to care for aging person's remains, etc. So we try to look at the life course perspective as a very structured and set of junctures, really. Yes.
Also, we like to look at how cultural tradition impact aging and aging experiences, and also the state policy. So we kind of, East Asian tradition has this long Confucius tradition, even though China, Japan, Korea, or other settings, they have their own maybe cultural history or interpretation, but this general Confucius idea is there. But then how it's aging, it's evolved or reinterpreted in as the countries modernize. So that's another aspect we'd look at. And of course, the state policy, how that also impact aging, especially we have China's one-child policy that really accelerated population aging in China. And then for China, we even have a term, right? You age before you get rich. So, wei fu xian ma. So that also means how both the state, family, and individual need to cope with the situation, come together to cope with the situation.
Now that you mention Confucian values, so caring for the elderly and filial piety are taught from kindergarten to East Asian kids. But your book argues that this traditional Confucian value does not quite fit the current society of East Asia anymore, especially not with the social changes brought by modernization. So I want to unpack this a little bit more. Perhaps we can begin with population because it's one of the center focuses of your book. So you give a lot of attention to the recent changes of population and the problems that rise from such changes. Could you speak more about this in terms of, say, what's happening in China?
Yes, I think the first thing to mention is that filial piety, when you dig into it, it's a much more multi-layered concept than when you initially just think about, oh, respect and care for elders. If you dig into it, it contains many different dimensions. So there's like obedience to elders, and that really doesn't fit very well today. But there's respect for elders. That fits a little better, but it becomes difficult when younger generations have so much more education and society is changing so rapidly. And then there's instrumental care, like hands-on care for elders. And that becomes much harder when we're talking about very mobile societies and dual career earning families among the children's generation. And then we have economic support for elders, and we have co-residence with elders. And the co-residence with elders has for many decades now becoming less and less popular. And then interestingly, for the financial support, depending on what part of East Asia you're talking about, and even like what part of China you're talking about, because of the growth of social welfare systems, support by adult children of the elders has become less necessary.
Interesting.
Do you I'll let others jump in though, because there's so much more.
Right. Dr. Zhang.
I was thinking that there was the other way around. The elder parents are helping their sometimes struggling middle-aged children or with childcare, definitely. It's more reciprocal, I think, when we look at the intergenerational relations. When Dr. Xie talk about the what is still relevant or what is probably not fitting to the contemporary society, and the other thing we can also say that it's this idea of continue the family line. So even though we don't think that, you know, in the traditional sense, that's also made part of filial piety. You have to continue the family line. Now it's more about your personal family or nuclear family, or some children may decide not to have children to the dislike of their parents, maybe. But so that can be another kind of a tension point between parents and children. But definitely the society have changed. But I think this general idea of elder care or providing parental support is still very dear to many. I know the Chinese adult children, I'm not sure it's that kind of sense still felt in Japan. Maybe Dr. Moore can speak more about that.
Yeah, I will just augment some of the points raised. I think one of the things that's happening, there are two themes that emerge. One is that there are now different options available to provide carers with some external support. So what we see here is that families are making a lot of choices about which services they would use to supplement family care in order to fulfill their Confucian values. And Confucian values remain important, for instance, that show of respect or that show of concern. Those things remain important. And so how those are interpreted and lived in this current day can be seen in perhaps the choices that mobile families make about what services that they can organize to enable that to happen. And in the process, there is also a great deal of tension or dilemma for families because they need to negotiate competing priorities. And we see that sort of tension in some of the case studies. There was a point raised about co-residence, which I think is fascinating because in East Asia in general, relative to, let's say, parts of Northern Europe, the level of co-residence is much, much higher among families in their households, far higher to this day. And so there is a proportionally higher co-residence. And yet our book shows quite a range of choices about this. Some of them, such as the chapter by Tang and Shay, that shows how older persons are choosing to live separately from their children. And that is seen as a kind of a novel way to deal with the new values of being independent for elders. So we see independent residence rather than co-residence. On the other hand, in Zhang's chapter, we see grandparents co-residing with their adult children to care for their younger offspring. And that is an instance where people are co-residing, showing the kind of care that Dr. Zhang just mentioned a moment ago, where older persons are doing a lot more to care for their younger members as a sort of a reciprocal way of being rather than simply receiving care as they get older. So we see quite a few different cases as the societies are all changing in this current day.
So just kind of a follow-up question for Dr. Moore. What are some of these, manifestation of such changes in Japan, for example?
Well, the biggest thing that probably has happened in the intervening years since the late 1990s, when a lot of initial research was done on this, is that the long-term care insurance policy was put in place. And this was put forth as a solution to the fact that a lot of care was being done in-house by family members. So the long-term care insurance system ensures that all members of the society over the age of 65 who qualify can access supplemental care that is provided both by private companies and also by government managed industries. And these types of care allow people to supplement or at least combine with what the people might do in the family. And I think the Japanese case shows also that there is the ethnography chapters we see in the book show how care has to extend not just into the end of life, but also beyond life. And so, for instance, Long and Campbell's chapter looks at how care happens for people even after their members of family have passed on. And that level of attention to post-death care is an interesting phenomenon that we see in their Japanese ethnographic case.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. nubooks.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Indeed. And how do people react to such public policies? Were they more in favor of it, or are there any aspects that they are against?
Well, it's very interesting you raised that in terms of what might be the social reactions to this level of socialized care given by government and market sources, in that some elements of the conservative sections of Japanese society, for instance, the society that values a more, let's say, conservative family-based gender notion, would want women and family members to continue to care for their elders in-house by themselves, and to uphold this level of gender care by women in the family is seen as a very dignified thing. So there are elements within society that oppose this shift toward public sources of care. Having said that, I think for the majority of the society, the availability of this long-term care insurance system has been a boon. It has been seen as good, but perhaps not enough. As the society becomes older, there are new demands for new types of care arrangements to meet the needs of the 21st century.
Interesting. What about in China? What kinds of public policies is China using to, I guess, to improve this problem of aging and lack of elderly care? And what are the reactions from its people?
Well, of course, there's the 2013 policy on the treatment of the elderly. And, you know, one response to that has been that it's basically an ideal statement, but there hasn't been much way to actually enforce the idea that adult children are required to take care of their elderly parents. And there's also a certain amount of loss of face for parents who were to take their children to court to try to get them to support them, although that happens sometimes. Dr. Zhang.
Yeah, China, it's a situation, we can say maybe very decentralized. So we don't have a uniform national policy on pension, or we don't even have a long-term care insurance system as Japan and Korea has. I think Japan is in 2000 and Korea had it in 2008. But China, we know, first of all, there's a huge divide between urban and rural. And then in urban China, you generally have a pension system. So the elderly do depend on pension for their financial support. And then they also have a kind of a debao for those who don't have a pension. But even within urban China, you have different cities may have a different policy. And then depend on their resources. So we really see that as a very decentralized situation. And then I think Shanghai or maybe some other cities are in a piecemeal. They're trying to put long-term care insurance in place. But I don't think they have a policy yet. And then even though we also have elder homes, they are totally out of pocket. So the expenses can be very high. And then you also have population that, you know, have money. So many of those newly built elder homes are really, I find it, you know, target those high-end population and very fancy, those high-end elder homes. And then, so that really showed this stratification of aging and the elder care. And then it's, I think, mostly driven by the market. That's, I think, the challenge that China is still facing. You know, it's a country that it's really GDP per capita is still pretty low, but your population aging is accelerated. Many people are entering in their old age, and you don't have enough resources to really cover this large population. And then at the same time, you do have people at the high income bracket, and then they can enjoy or they can have access to those,
Yeah, that's quite a big problem. But you just mentioned Korea. So does Korea have a better policy or policies?
As Dr. Jung just mentioned, Korea does have a long-term care insurance policy. And it has looked to Japan a lot as a model. One thing that is different in Korea, at least as of the writing of the book, and I'll defer to Dr. Morris to whether anything has changed in Japan since then, but as of the writing of the book, Korea did allow family caregivers to be paid for caregiving because of concern, especially about low-income family caregivers, having to take care of their relatives, but, you know, not having enough to really live on. And so that is also something that Hong Kong was starting to pilot experimenting with. What is happening in terms of that at this point, in Japan, Dr. Moore, is it still something that's resisted the idea of paying family to take care?
Indeed, I think the family based care was that would be paid as it is in some other countries, as you just mentioned, in other parts of East Asia or in Germany, for instance. That idea of paying for labor that happens inside the household by other family members was ultimately rejected as a measure, as a component of the long-term care insurance system. So to this day, the payment must be made only to providers of care, and those who are in the family are not remunerated for the care that they might provide in-house.
So in examining...
I just have one thing to add about that policy in Korea, because you had kind of asked a question about, you know, maybe what is better in Korea. And I think the jury's out as to whether that's better or worse, because as authors Lee and Chi write in their Korea chapter, it is a positive in that low-income folks who have to take care of their elderly can have sort of a better subsistence, a better life with these stipends. However, there have been problems with a minority of family members slacking off and really neglecting their elders and still collecting the money, and problems of family members who just really don't have the proper skills or care to take good care of their elders. So it's a mixed picture.
The opposition to providing paid care by family members in Japan had a slightly different history, and it's quite interesting in that there were some feminist groups in Japan who were quite vocal in saying that doing a payment to family members would reinforce the expectation that it is a family who is meant to provide care, and that it is female family members who are expected to provide care. So the feeling was that by removing that expectation altogether, it would be a more progressive step for the society to shift it out of that domain.
Yeah, that would probably be ideal. So do you, in examining the problems with elder care in these three countries, what do you see as some of the similarities in the causes of these problems and the solution of the problems? I know that the book or the articles cover a lot of aspects for the causes, for the solutions, but if you have to choose one that you think is most pressing, what would that be?
I think first, may I be a professor for a moment and question the premise. So one part of our book is questioning the idea of aging as a problem. You know, aging is a problem for those who are lucky enough to get there, right? There, so it's both a blessing and also a challenge for individuals and also societies. And one aspect of filial piety that Dr. Zhang referred to, but I think we may not have underscored enough, is that for older adults, for the elderly, part of filial piety is making sure to nurture the descendants enough, their children and their grandchildren, to carry on the family line for the ancestors. And so as Dr. Yunxiang Yan, or Yan Yunxiang, as we say in China, has argued, there's this tension in filial piety between wanting to take care of those older than you and wanting to take care of those younger than you, because filial piety includes carrying on the generations and trying to have them be successful, for the descendants to be successful. And so I think that, you know, our book is fundamentally about not just caregiving for the elderly, but caregiving by the elderly. And caregiving by the elderly for themselves, for their children, even as adults, for the grandchildren, for each other, for their spouses, I'm trying to remember what the original question was, since I questioned the question, maybe I'll just stop there and let someone else pick up.
Well, I think indeed the solution that Professor Shea just mentioned is one kind of remedy or social societal response to what was perceived as by some as a problem or by others as a big dilemma. And that is to negotiate the fact that their care is required by both the ones above and the ones below. And so the older persons themselves decide to take matters into their own hands and to embrace an ethic of perhaps mutual assistance within couples or being independent from family. Those are new values. And then these are manifested in the cases we see, for instance, in Professor Shea's chapter, where spouses do a lot more care for each other than they may have done in previous eras, for instance. And so there's been a sort of a negotiation of those tensions. And what's perhaps remarkable and quite important to sort of note is that shift from when Charlotte Eichels wrote her monograph with her colleagues, and the book is a partner book to our book. In that book, there was much less of an emphasis on the care done by elders for elders and care done by elders for younger generations. So we see people, older persons, sort of stepping up to the plate in expressing aspects of caregiving to each other and to those around them.
And interestingly, in some of our chapters, like the one by Min Zhang and the one by Dorota Schwarzka, is some elders sometimes seeing caregiving for their children or grandchildren being the problem, to needing to escape, you know, being taken advantage of, basically. So what we try to do is, you know, there's a big body of scholarship on support for the aged, but there's another big body of scholarship on productive aging. And so what we've tried to do is bring them together, because oftentimes they're treated separately. And it's really interesting when you bring them together and think about the pluses and minuses of caregiving both for and by the elderly.
Interesting. It's kind of ironic to see how the rich meanings of filial piety has grown into an aged problem now. So Dr. Zhang, what do you think is the most pressing cause that's leading to all these problems?
I think probably a lot of it's a combination of a lot of factors. In China, I think, I'm sorry, I have this thing, I don't know if it's making noise, it's really interrupting you guys. If so, I'm sorry about that. In China, we have this one-child policy that really, you have a whole generation, all of a sudden, now those generation parents are entering old age. And then you have also this, they only have one child. And then there was this concern of how to provide care for their aging parents. And then at the same time, the parents, like Dr. Mo and Dr. Xie also talk about, there was this new value of the parents feels it's their duty to see their children to be successful for their career. So they don't want the taking care of them to be a burden to their children. So you have this both, on the one hand, you have children have this anxiety of how to provide care or worry about that. And on the other hand, the parents know they only have one child, and then their child also has to succeed in this very competitive economic environment. And then so how not to be a burden to their children. But then at the same time, they also want that care or want their children or their only child to care. So there was this emotions. And then in addition to the reality of, you know, of care, that's still looming. I think for some, it's already, I think a little bit older generation of those one-child parents, they're entering their 70s now. So they're really begin facing this. I think we do see this development of this new value to be more independent, to keep themselves, for the parents, to keep themselves busy, productive, fit, and so that they don't have to depend on, you know, or to prolong that process as long as possible. On the other hand, you also begin to see development, I call it the peer aging. That is, the parents or this generation, they're developing this horizontal friendship or social networking with the peers of their age, not the vertically, you know, depending on their children. So because this whole generation, they have that similar experience going through cultural revolution, sent down to the countryside, coming back. So this kind of friendship we actually see more and more. And then some people even say that they were going to age together instead of depending on their children. So this kind of self-help and then also help each other. So I call it a peer aging. I don't know if it makes sense, but that really it seemed to be a trend among the people who are still marching towards that eventual, 70s and 80s, how long that can last. But I think, so you see those people are very active. They go to 老年大学, the university is for seniors. And sometimes they go there to really expand their friendship, like to know more people of similar interest. And then also to expand their hobbies or pick up new skill, so that as soon as they keep themselves busy and not worry too much, then they can maybe stay healthy that way. So you can see those are the strategies. People know this is the reality. So you say, what causes the problem? So they don't have anybody to turn to, right? So because everybody is facing the same problem. So China is all of a sudden, this generation of parents into old age. And then I think they are developing very good strategies of dealing with this. At the same time, they want to also keep good relationship with their children. I think that the parents know that if they are not burdening them too much, then that's a good relationship too. So their children is not feeling burnout. I think to some extent, this reality forces people to actually become more towards more autonomy, like a making decision for themselves, and then also I don't know if that's a word, like a be responsible for their own aging. So that sense, that's very different from the traditional value. But at the same time, I think it's actually influenced by the traditional value, because they still want to help their children. So they keep themselves healthy and fit and not burden their children. That's a kind of reciprocal relationship. And then also, you know, they want their children not to be dragged down, or 拖后腿, in Chinese, let's say the word, right? So I think this is a combination of factor, right? The demography and then also the market economy and this idea of self-control and responsibility for themselves. So we do see that kind of directions. And then of course, this just show another big divide in the countryside. The rural parents, they do not have that luxury. And very often the rural parents, elderly, they have to take care of grandchildren. And then very often they are left behind taking care of their own aging, and then they don't have any pensions to support themselves. So, and of course, no senior universities for them to go. So I feel like in the city, it's really one thing, and then countryside, it's quite different.
And if we take the theme of, wanting warm feelings and good relationship and family harmony, all of which are part of traditional values, but they've become emphasized much more relative to other traditional values. And we see this in Professor Schwartzke's chapter in Korea with elders who were forced into labor on Sakhalin Island. That was occupied by Japan during World War II. And then in recent decades, South Korea decided to welcome some of those forced laborers to come back, but not their children. And so you would think, why would they want to go back to a country they hadn't been for decades and decades and leave their children behind? But they wanted to do it to maintain family harmony by putting some space between and taking advantage of the housing benefit and the living benefit that South Korea was going to provide to them if these elders went back to South Korea. And then I also wanted to pick up on the independence and self-reliance theme, because we not only see that for China, but we also see that for Japan. And Dr. Moore talks about that very eloquently in her chapter.
And South Korea, too. The Chin East article, the long-term care insurance, the one very positive impact is that it helps supporting the independence of the elderly too. So, and then that seemed to be also a new value.
There are so many fascinating aspects that you just mentioned that I wish we had time to get more into. And the book really, it's so rich in its materials and how in the disciplines that it covers. I wish we could have all the authors here to talk about it. But unfortunately, we're running out of time. So I'll just ask one last question. So I recently watched this movie called I Care a Lot. You may have heard of it. I guess it's based on a real story, and it talks about the problem with elder care in the U.S. So I guess this trouble with elder care isn't a standalone issue in East Asia. So how do you think your book, how do you think all these chapters fit into the bigger picture of aging generally in the world?
Oh my goodness. I mean, if we're, whether, you know, we're talking about 2050 or beyond that, so many in the countries in the world are aging, have aging populations that will be, you know, unprecedented levels of elderly folks, you know, getting to, you know, from now you have, you know, Japan is relatively high with, the percentage of elders in the 20s, but we're going to be in, you know, 30% elderly, 40% elderly in some countries within our lifetimes. And so the challenges and the creative solutions, whether at the policy level or at the individual or the family level, I think that both the problems and the strategies that we see here in terms of the way people make meaning of these things, the way people turn what is a burden also into something that helps them with their self-cultivation and, you know, their journey as a person. I find a lot of wisdom in what I learned from these chapters. And I do think that it, like you pointed out, it does go beyond Asia, really, East Asia.
Well, I think the terminology that scholars in different parts of the world use to refer to this value of how to care for others, both vulnerable and loved ones, that those terms slightly differ. So for instance, in the US, there is a lot more influence of, let's say, the idea of intergenerational contract. What does it mean? Or what is intergenerational solidarity in an era where there are new and competing demands for women and men who are in the workforce and cannot provide for their loved ones in the way they did? And people such as Ronald and Jacqueline Angel have written about this in the U.S. case to deal with the issues in the U.S. And I think we need not always be bound by the terms that are local, just so that we keep our purview open to how different scholars in different geographic contexts have come up with terms to encapsulate this need to care for the vulnerable and need to care for loved ones. And I do think that the future is very much open to how the societies deal with the blessing of longevity, because all the societies are, due to better medical care, seeing a greater longevity as a trend. And so what that longevity portends for each country is obviously going to be negotiated on a policy level and as Professor Shea said, on a meaning level, like what does it mean and how do we reckon with it? Yeah.
One more thing I will add is that our book, it's a series, right? It's called The Life Course, Culture and Aging and Global Transformation. So it's one of those book series. So you can see this aging is a global trend, and each country or each region, they might also develop their way of coping. And I think our book, it's also contributing to this literature to get people prepared to the challenges ahead.
That also. Yeah. Oh, I just realized that maybe this is a good point for a plug, which is that our book has hardcover, it has ebook, and this and within the next half year or so, there's also going to be a paperback coming out. And Dr. Zhang has been our inaugural member of our group to use the book in teaching, and she's finding it's resonating quite well with the undergrad she's teaching.
That's awesome. I really hope your book, when the paperback comes out too, of course, that it can encourage more families to think about this problem that many of us will face in the future. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
For our listeners, to learn more about filial piety and aging in modern Asia, make sure to check out this book, Beyond Filial Piety, Rethinking Aging and Caregiving in Contemporary East Asian Societies. This is Jingyi Li from New Books in Japanese Studies. I will see you in our next episode.